we're looking back in time. Military History with Damien Fenton. He's this week's After Dinner speaker. And he, like a lot of guests, it's lovely to see you face to face again, Damien.
Yeah, Brian. Yeah, no, good to be here.
The first battle of El Alamein. Now, I only vaguely knew there were two. I mean, El Alamein is synonymous with the idea of the turning point in the Second World War. There was El Alamein, there was Stalingrad. And I guess in the war that the Americans had with the Japanese, there was Midway. But I didn't know there were two battles. Wasn't one enough?
Yeah, a lot of people, certainly these days, don't realise there are actually two battles of El Alamein, the first and the second. Although, people often refer to the Battle of El Alamein and they're really thinking of the second, which was Montgomery's big offensive, which saw the German Africa Corps and the Italians decisively beaten in North Africa and pushed out of Egypt and back through Libya. And the New Zealanders played a prominent role in that, of course. But before that battle, there was another one in the same area, and it was the first Battle of El Alamein, and that was about 4 or 5 months earlier in July 1942.
Right. So 80 years ago this month.
80 years ago this month, that's right.
And at that point, the Africa Corps, which was led by General Erwin Rommel, was it making a lot of progress heading towards, I guess, was trying to get to Cairo and the Suez Canal?
Yeah, the ultimate aim was to conquer Egypt, and by conquering Egypt, not only would it secure the Axis control of the Mediterranean, because you'd force the British Mediterranean fleet would have to evacuate from Alexandria, but by taking the Suez Canal, you'd also cut off a major British line of communications with India in the Far East. So, it was a number one objective, and June 1942, it looked as if, for many people, it looked as if Rommel and the Germans were on the verge of succeeding and breaking through. El Alamein is only 40 miles away from Alexandria.
Did you say 14 or 40?
40.
Right. Still pretty close.
Yeah, very, very close. And in fact, in June, the British basically suffered the British 8th Army, which the New Zealanders were a part of, along with Australians. There was the 4th Indian Division, and there was a South African Division. And free French, Greeks, and others, they just suffered a major defeat in the Gazala battles, and the front line had basically split wide open. And Rommel, true to his style, leading from the front, pushed his men as far as he could, dangerously stretching his supply lines, but going as far as he could to try and get to Cairo. He basically ran out of steam just at El Alamein, where the British decided to put up a last stand. But he continued to try and smash his way through the British defences at El Alamein for most of July. And it's that last stand along the El Alamein line, as they called it, which is really crucial at this point, because if he does break through, there's nothing between him and the Nile Delta.
What was the country like around El Alamein? What is it like?
Okay, so El Alamein itself is really a railway station.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, on the sort of rail line that's pretty close to the coast. It's not very far away from the coastline with the Mediterranean. And as far as the the reason that the British commander, Claude Auchinleck, decided it was a good spot for a defence was because to the south of El Alamein, there's this thing called the Qattara Depression, a massive area of really bad country. It's really, really soft sand. Vehicles just bogged down sort of very quickly. And it was basically a no-go area for both sides.
Including tanks.
So he was using that to anchor his position to the south. And then to the north, there was the coast with the Mediterranean. And that gap at El Alamein was the smallest of anywhere in Egypt. So it gave him a very small front line of about 100K or so to defend, which relatively speaking, in terms of Second World War terms, that's not too bad. And so he was able to make a stand there, and then the idea was to build up the British 8th Army to the point where it could go over to the attack and then force Rommel back.
But obviously Rommel would have realised what was going on. How much was that first battle the result of the Germans already having pushed too far, and how much was it the result of desperate defence by the Allies?
It was both. So Rommel is extremely conscious that if he gives the British a chance to regroup, they'll solidify this line, they'll try and build it up. And so he's pushing his men to breaking point, really, to try and break through, to make that final breakthrough. He's even though he'd won the battles at Gazala, they had been quite costly. And for the Alamein battles, the Africa Corps was really fighting on, it was really fighting on empty, and literally in many cases, because the fuel supply lines for Rommel at Alamein, he basically had to rely on motor transport going back 600 miles back to Benghazi to get fuel delivered.
And I'm imagining these are not asphalt roads. These would be rough desert tracks.
It's a single road, really. And so it's vulnerable to Allied air attack. And, of course, the vehicles can break down. And, in fact, and just getting along that 600 miles, I mean, for example, for every 100 litres of petrol that was landed at Benghazi to supply his troops, 30 litres was used up just by the trucks bringing the rest of it up to the front line.
You can think about the economics of that.
Yeah, it's he's on a hiding to nothing, really.
There's not much further, and the fuel used to get the fuel to where he needs it is more than the fuel he's got.
Yeah, exactly. So he knows that there's some very big constraints and he's only got a limited opportunity. So he throws everything at the Alamein positions, and certainly for the first half of July, to try and break through. And the British, of course, because they're dealing with an army that's been beaten and defeated in many ways, and so they're having to cobble together a defence from units that are disorganised. Many of them had lost a lot of their equipment. They lost a lot of men, including a lot of their officers. So these units are being hastily patched up back together and thrown back into the line to try and make a stand. And initially, it's that they make a stand with British, Indian, and South African troops, and then they bring in an Australian division that had been stationed in Syria just to guard against a German breakthrough through the Caucasus, which looked like it might happen at Stalingrad until the Russians turned the tide there. And so that Australian division, the 9th Division, was rushed into the line. And the New Zealanders were brought up as well. So by the middle of July, you've got the New Zealand and the Australian divisions there. And Rommel finally has to admit that he can't keep attacking. And in fact, his commanders are pleading with him that we can't keep doing this. The men are going to break. And the Italians were furious as well, because they were taking huge losses in these attacks, which Rommel didn't really seem to care much about.
Yeah, the Italians kind of got the blame for, although actually, even if they were guilty of not fighting enthusiastically for Hitler, I don't really blame them. In fact, I'd say good on them, really. But their losses were terrible as well, weren't they, Damien?
Yeah, because, the British, Auchinleck actually deliberately targeted the Italians. And in the second half of July, he launches a number of local counterattacks aimed specifically at the Italian infantry units that Rommel's brought forward. And he attacks them on the basis that infantry holds ground. You can't, tanks and artillery and infantry can capture ground, but only infantry can hold ground. And the bulk of Rommel's infantry were actually Italian. He had very few German infantry, particularly by this stage, because of his losses. So Auchinleck decided that if he can target the Italian infantry and wear them down and break their morale, then that's going to create major problems for Rommel, because he's going to have to fill those gaps left by the Italians. He's going to have to stretch his German forces even further. So he launches a series of attacks in the middle of July through to the end of the month, which is when the battle is seen to sort of come to an end and both sides sort of come to a stalemate. Unfortunately, while the defensive battles in the first half went particularly well for the British, although they were very costly, these attacks actually turn into disasters. And unfortunately, it's the Australians and the New Zealanders who bear the brunt of these disasters, because they're picked as the freshest troops to lead these attacks.
And why were these attacks disastrous?
There's a host of reasons, but at bottom it comes to the fact that the New Zealanders and the Australian infantry were relying on British armour support, and on numerous occasions that British armour support failed to arrive, and that's mainly through a lack of communication. British communications weren't very good. Their radio sets broke down a lot. They also had, and of course the Germans were trying to jam them. A number of the armoured formations that were being used were recently arrived reinforcements. They weren't combat experienced. And a number of those British armoured regiments are also British cavalry regiments that had converted from horses to armour, and they very much had a cavalry mentality, which was sort of charge and sort of ignore everything else around them. They weren't very used to working with infantry, and they really didn't see it as their role. And so they tend to operate by themselves. And so there was a big, it basically came down to a communication breakdown between the British armour and the New Zealand and Australian infantry. But it meant that the New Zealanders and Australians, even though they, for example, the New Zealanders at Rewisat Ridge, they took their objectives in a night attack. They took this ridge, which is a small piece of high ground. not without some heavy fighting and some losses, but they did take it. And in the morning, they were expecting British armour to arrive to support them for the inevitable German counterattack. Well, these tanks arrived, and at first they thought, well, that's good. You know, this is all going to plan. And then they realised the tanks had these black crosses on them, and they were German tanks, and there was no British armour to be seen.
Right.
And they effectively overran a New Zealand battalion, which was more or less forced to surrender.
Is that where your great-uncle was?
My great-uncle, Jerry Marnie, he was with the 21st Battalion, which was in the 5th Brigade. And he was killed in the fighting on the 22nd of July during a German air raid on the company headquarters that he was the company sergeant major in.
It had been a pretty nightmare year for the New Zealand Division, really, hadn't it? I mean, they were stuck in Crete and retreated from Greece, Crete.
That was the year previously, and they had actually, they'd recovered from that in terms of the losses had been made up, and they had actually spent some time reorganising and retraining in Syria as well. They'd been posted to the border there around Aleppo for the opening months of 1942. But then with the disaster at Gazala, they'd been rushed back into the line. So in early 1942, the division was in pretty good shape, but then these disastrous counterattacks in July shatter the division in the space of a month. The New Zealanders take over 4,000 casualties in a couple of weeks. And effectively means the New Zealand Division is no longer combat effective through August and into September, although it's withdrawn and rebuilt and is back in the line in time for the second Battle of Alamein, the more famous one, where Montgomery was in charge.
Now, Montgomery's the hero in terms of generals, but does he get a little bit too much credit for what happened at El Alamein?
The Second Battle of Alamein is definitely Montgomery's victory, but some would say that he gets a little too much credit for the fact that the Eighth Army is in better shape when he arrives than he may have made it out to be. That Auchinleck, even though he doesn't get much credit, and yes, the counterattacks in the second half of July turned out to be disasters, he was actually on the right track strategically and operationally, and he was trying to reform the way the British Army was fighting. So, for example, he was aware that the British really needed to get much better at infantry and armour cooperation, but he just didn't have the time to instil that in July. These units were basically being thrown into the line as they arrived, and it was only 3 months later that that a lot of that training had started to take place with the stalemate and a lull in the fighting that these units got to start to train properly, that Montgomery inherits a force that is much more capable and much more effective at combined arms warfare.
How much did New Zealanders know back here about how desperate the situation was in July of 1942?
People were aware of it. In fact, it's a pretty grim time of the war. I mean, in retrospect, we sort of tend to think, 1942 is the turning of the tide. But in the middle of 1942, things are looking pretty grim. The German offensive that will ultimately lead to the Battle of Stalingrad is in full throttle, and the Russians are being smashed. They're being pushed back all the way through what is now modern Ukraine, and the Germans look like they're winning there. The Japanese, of course, have just entered the war at the start of the year and have had 6 months of just victory after victory. They've overrun all of Southeast Asia. They've bombed Darwin. And New Zealanders are now at home and now thinking they're under direct threat of Japanese invasion. Then, of course, you have this breakthrough in North Africa where the Gazala battles, where it looks like Rommel and the Italians are about to take Egypt. So it's looking pretty grim. In some ways, it's possibly the grimmest time of the war, certainly for a New Zealand audience to read what's going on in the papers.
Did your great-uncle know how desperate things were, do you think?
I imagine he did. He'd joined the army in 1939 along with my grandfather. The two were really good mates. So they joined up just before the war broke out. So they went from being privates in 1939 to sergeant majors within the space of 18 months.
Wow.
Which just shows you how small our peacetime army was
and
what expansion does. And Jerry, I mean, he'd been aware, and he'd been in the Western Desert, as the New Zealanders and other Commonwealth troops called it. He'd been in the desert for about 6 months at that point. So he'd seen it all. And he was certainly there. He was with the division in Syria, but he knew, and from talking to the others, he would have known, how desperate things were. The Germans and the Italians had never got this close to Cairo and Alexandria before. So I think the men were all well aware that this was. And in fact, in the retreat in June, when it did look like it was all over, the combat units were making jokes, because back in Cairo you had the British embassy and the British command were burning their papers. The British Mediterranean fleet did actually evacuate Alexandria, which added to the panic in the streets, and they talked about the Cairo races, where all these sort of rear echelon and supply units were abandoning everything they had and sort of grabbing anything that moved to get back to Cairo. So things were desperate. They knew it was really a last stand fight.
What were the crucial things that stopped the Nazis, stopped Rommel?
The things that stopped Rommel, I mean, it comes back to logistics. He was just so far at the end of his supply lines. He simply could not supply the troops he had with everything they needed, which was partly his, in that sense, he was a victim of his own success. But also he was a victim of Auchinleck's planning in terms of stabilizing the front, getting those units to stand fast, slowly building them back up, resupplying them. Because the British had supply problems too. They couldn't supply through the Mediterranean at this point because it was virtually an Axis lake. So their supply lines had to go all the way around the Horn of Africa and then up through the Suez Canal. But it was, in the end, it was the Italians and Rommel that lost the logistics war. There was also his hubris, the fact that he refused to give his men a chance to recover. But also the fact that the combat troops, even though there might have been a panic amongst some of the rear area troops in June 42, the combat troops in the New Zealand Division, the 9th Australian Division, they never felt that they were in any way inferior to the Africa Corps. They would talk about the Desert Fox. Rommel had this reputation. But when it came down to they never felt that they were that on any given day, on a fair fight, if you like, they couldn't beat the Germans, and they certainly had no respect for the Italians, which is a bit unwarranted, because the Italians could actually put up a pretty good fight in certain circumstances. But either way, I mean, that was in the end, that was probably to their advantage that they held the Italians in such contempt, because they simply, they felt that they had a that they could beat the Germans and the Italians on any given day.
Damien, fascinating having you in. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Brian.
Damien Fenton, back with more military history in about 2.5 months.